took a panoramic view, a lot, bunch of pictures, and spliced them all together. And yeah, you know, you got to see what the solar system looked like. You know, Uranus, Saturn. You know, what it looked like from up above the ecliptic plane. I thought that was pretty neat. And that's a picture that's published in some books. You can probably get it online as well. One more thing, let me drop it. Fellow, I forgot his name, brought up the Stardust mission. That was one of my favorite missions. I found that one when it was launched in 1999, and it lasted about 6 or 7 years before they had that sample return mission. They had an aerogel mitt that captured substances from the comet Philp 2, WILD, it's not wild, but it's Philp 2, and it captured everything on this aerogel tennis racket type mitt, returned it in a capsule, landed in Utah some 6 or 7 years after launch. But I know what he's talking about. It did pick up, let me drop it. Stellar, I guess the word is stellar particles, they did a test. They wanted to find out what was out, you know, in deep space, and they did pick up particles, but I never heard that they picked up any antimatter, so he's right about that. Just regular matter, but floating around in there. Middle of nowhere, you know, so it was a double thing. The main thing was to go pick up the debris from that comet. It went right into the comet Corona, and that was successful. But they did do a test in the middle of nowhere and find out what was out there as well, and they got a hold of it, and I understand they're still doing scientific research on this stuff. That came back in 06, what, 6, 7 years ago. Back to you, Dick, WS2X.
Gentlemen, this is you.
Please.
That was a triple. Wes, I heard you as one of those voices. Who was the other voice?
2SLW, I ask for another comment, please.
Go ahead, John.
They use volunteers on the internet to check some of the data from the Stardust mission. It was called Stardust at Home, where you were looking for the tracks made by the particles in the aerogel. It was really interesting. You used like a virtual microscope, and you could sit at the computer at home and do that, and look for interstellar dust grains, and maybe find an interstellar dust grain and get to name it. I'll back to the net.
Yeah, John, you were talking earlier about the fact that the dust they collected on that tennis racket on the WILD, I think was the name of it, WILD spacecraft. By definition, everything they gather would have to be matter, not antimatter, because your tennis racket and that sticky material and whatever that's gathering, it's all made out of matter. And if any of the dust you collected, and how in the world would that dust, if it was antimatter, get into the solar system and survive? There'd be a whole big rigmarole about that. So if any of that was antimatter, just touching your tennis racket would annihilate it immediately and annihilate some little pieces of your tennis racket. So the fact that everything we've seen is matter is no surprise. How do you collect antimatter? Well, in the case of some of the experiments they've done on the Large Hadron Collider, they have been able to generate some antimatter. And now they've made this magnetic chamber, so to speak, where they could hold a very small particle of antimatter for some period of time. If it touches the walls of the chamber, it's game over. It explodes. It gets annihilated. So by way of carefully controlled magnetic fields, they've been able to hold on to a very small chunk of antimatter, probably one positron worth of it, for as much as 16 minutes is a limit. And they're talking about slowing it down, its velocity, even more by using laser devices, so that they intend to hold on to it even longer and maybe collect more of it. one of the experiments they would love to do is to hold on to a piece of antimatter for a long enough period of time to find out how does it behave with gravity. Does an antimatter particle fall up instead of fall down? A certain percentage of people are speculating the antimatter will operate in the opposite way in a gravity field. It'll fall up. And if that's true, if you can now gather a large enough amount of antimatter, put
repeater, time out.
Gather a large enough piece of antimatter and put it in the middle of your spacecraft, and if it happens to fall up instead of fall down, boy, that would be a beautiful propulsion system. So, other than that, though, antimatter is a very difficult substance to deal with in this particular solar system and galaxy, probably. But all of these very high-power cosmic rays, some of them being antimatter, is darn interesting stuff to me. Now, as Paul was also mentioning, they were afraid to speculate about it in the beginning. They knew that some of the galaxies had a very strong, supermassive black hole in the center, holding it all together. And they were afraid to speculate. I think the latest speculation is essentially every single galaxy has one or more supermassive black holes in the center that holds the whole galaxy together. And they have discovered one particular galaxy out there where the supermassive black hole is 17 billion solar masses. That's just out of sight. How in the world can you get that much matter in one spot? And by the way, that particular black hole, I think that black hole itself, even though it's an extremely compact structure because of all of its gravity, would still have a diameter bigger than this particular solar system, bigger than the distance out to Pluto as a black hole. Again, out of sight. Let me drop. I promised you guys a little bit of a puzzle while John is maybe reading some of his email. And that sun is giving you 1,300 watts per square meter. In other words, at high noon, the amount of solar energy hitting your backyard, each square meter is roughly 1,300 watts. Your body has an area in the vicinity of a square meter. So you lay on the blanket in the beach in the summertime, and the sun is beating down on you. More than 1,000 watts of solar energy is hitting your body. And by way of your sweating, cooling system and whatever, you can handle that, particularly if you've got the right kind of a SPF, a solar protection stuff on you, so you're not getting too sunburned. But now, one of the experiments I did in my youth, I guess I was around 8 years of age, I got a hold of the small magnifying glass that the family had, and I don't know where I got the idea from, but I took the magnifying glass outside with a piece of newspaper, held the magnifying glass just the right distance, so I was focusing the sun on the newspaper. And my small little magnifying glass would heat up a very bright dot on that newspaper and make it smoke. And then I eventually got a hold of a larger magnifying glass, one that was about 3.5 inches in diameter, I think it was. And boy, you got a lot more results out of that. You focus the sun with that larger magnifying glass on the newspaper, and you now know what a science fiction movie called Fahrenheit 451 is about. Can we drop? In that science fiction movie, some really terrible society decided that the general population should not have books, and they're going to burn up all the books. And the name of the science fiction is the fact that the spontaneous ignition point for ordinary paper is 451 degrees Fahrenheit. You warm up paper to 451 degrees Fahrenheit, it will burst into flame. That's the ignition temperature. So with this larger magnifying glass of mine, particularly when I aimed it at the black newspaper print where it's absorbing more, and by the way, you got to be careful of that experiment. The sun focused on a large magnifying glass on a piece of newspaper is a very bright dot, which is at the threshold that could give you some eye damage if you stare at it for a long enough period of time, which is another thing to worry about. But anyhow, and by the way, whenever you've got any kind of binoculars or telescope that's capable of looking at the sun, be very careful. That 1,300 watts per square meter can give you a hell of a lot of power coming down that binoculars or telescope of yours, and capable of doing a tremendous amount of eye damage and or damaging of the eyepiece of your telescope. I'll get into that later. So this larger magnifying glass gave me a much bigger, brighter, hotter dot, and I immediately could turn the newspaper into fire. I could light newspaper easily on a high noon, sunny day with this larger magnifying glass. So here's the question. if I get bigger and bigger magnifying glasses and assume now that it's got the right kind of coating so that the light wave is going through it without much reflection, assume that it is a compound magnifying glass where there is no chromatic aberration, it's a multiple coupled type lens, and it's got enough accuracy so that there's no spherical aberration. So I've got a real good magnifying glass with no spherical aberration, no coma distortion, no chromatic aberration. It's really giving you, across the whole optical region, perfect focusing, so to speak.
Repeater, timeout.
Perfect focusing of the sun. I've gone way beyond the point where I'm now catching newspaper on fire. I now want to start doing some welding. I want to start, melting down metals and whatever. I want to start really having some fun with this thing. So I'm using larger and larger magnifying glasses. And by the way, there is a website where a guy takes a Fresnel lens, a great big Fresnel lens, and focuses the sun on various objects and has a lot of fun with that. So here's the question. If I've got good enough focus, and I'm properly using larger and larger magnifying glasses, where more and more kilowatts of solar energy is going into that dot of where I focused it, can I get any temperature that I want? What's the maximum temperature I could generate in that manner? What's your guys' feeling on that? Obviously getting to 451 Fahrenheit is easy. Can I get to 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, 50,000? How many degrees Fahrenheit or centigrade could I get if I use a big enough magnifying glass on a bright sunny day with no distortion? How hot a dot do you think I could get? Give me a call, let us first, and so we'll take you guys in order for an estimation on this one. KQLIW in the TechNet listening. Give me a call, let us as to who's got a guess on this one. You're telling me you guys don't have a guess? Is there any limit to the temperature I can get on that focus dot with a large enough high performance magnifying glass? Is there any limit to the temperature I could get?
N2SLW, I'll make a guess.
Go right ahead, John.
Somewhere over 1,000 degrees, because the lens would start to deteriorate.
Hold on now. The lens itself is only looking at the normal solar input. That's not where it's being focused. It's outside of the lens where it's being focused. So you're not putting the lens under any real stress here, John. I'm asking, at the point where the lens is focusing all that solar energy, is there a limit to the temperature I can get in that focused dot? N2SLW, KQLIW.
You're asking me to stick my foot in it again. Dick, I withdraw my offer to contribute.
WI2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I got this John hanging out there. He stuck his neck out. I'll stick my neck out as well. I would say you got to convert the, you said, what, 1,300 watts per square meter. So whatever that is, into BTUs. You know, you have, once you find that conversion point, how many watts, 1,300 watts, I could convert it to horsepower. I know what it is for horsepower, but what is it for temperature? So I'll say as big as, you know, if you had 1,000-foot diameter of magnifying glass, you add up whatever the square meters are, and that times 1,300 is going to give you how many watts, and how many watts of, you know, of energy focuses in one spot. So because I can't do the math, I can't give you a number, but I'm going to say as big as the magnifying glass will go, you know? I don't think there's a limit. Back to you, Dick.
Echo 3 Zulu Tango Zulu V3 Zeta.
Scott recognized, and I'm going to get to Scott in a minute. You and I can easily buy a Fresnel lens, a plastic Fresnel lens, one of these flat sheet magnifying glass things, that's very close to one square meter. So with that, if I buy one of high enough quality, I can gather very close to gather very close to 1,300 watts of solar energy. By way of the focus I could get with that, depending on what the focal length is, I could probably focus down to something in the vicinity of an 8-inch diameter dot. So I can take 1,300 watts, focus it down to something like an 8-inch diameter dot, and when you do that, don't look at it. It's going to be extremely bright. I mean, don't look at it directly without your welding hood, if you know what I mean. So I could get 1,300 watts focused down to something like an eighth of an inch or maybe even a little bit smaller. That's a hell of a lot of steam. You calculate that 1,300 watts, that's 1,300 joules per second, and we can convert that into BTUs if you like that system of units. Joules, ergs, watts, we can convert it into all kinds of units. It's a lot of steam. And now, if you're worried about the fact that the air running by is going to be... cooling it, I could always have a nice clear surface on the side of a box where inside the box there is a vacuum with a black object inside that I'm heating up. So I could stop the air from cooling it off, but I'm still asking, under ideal conditions, what's the maximum temperature you think I could generate? Let's see what Scott's got to say about this one. BE3ZTZK2LAW. Go ahead, Scott.
BE3ZTZ, Scott in Toronto, Canada, returning. Does the answer not lie along the logic that if the light source is the sun, whatever the temperature of the fusion reaction is, at the ratio of the capture area of your magnifying glass to the surface area, less the energy lost in transit, multiplied by the gain of the magnifying glass, would be the maximum temperature that you could create the point source, the pinpoint. BE3ZTZ.
Okay. You're getting close, Scott, to what's really going on here. What goes on in the center of the sun, that nuclear reaction, has been described as 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. 27 million degrees Fahrenheit is the center of the sun. However, you wait 100,000 years, those heat waves coming out of the center of the sun eventually boil up to the surface. That surface is something like a million diameter thing that you and I call the sun. And optically speaking, the surface of the sun optically looks like something like 5,500 degrees, I think that's centigrade. So something like 5,000 degrees centigrade is the surface of the sun, the visual surface of the sun. Yeah, there's a corona beyond that that's at a million degrees, but it's not optical. So the optical portion of the sun, and we're doing optical focusing with our magnifying glass, we're starting off at something like 5,600 degrees, I think it's centigrade. Here's the question. I'm taking a hell of a lot of that energy of the sun, a square meter of it that hits the Earth. With my square meter Fresnel lens, I'm focusing it down to a dot of, let me pick a number, an 8-inch diameter. If I get real good focus, maybe I can get it to a 16th of an inch diameter. If I go through the conversions of that, if I use just pure mathematics naively, I could calculate that I could get, let me pick a number, 15,000 degrees at the center of that dot where I focused. Would that happen? If the mathematics tells me I'm taking enough energy, focusing it down to a dot that's small enough, and that dot itself is in a vacuum box where it's not being cooled by the convection air nearby, could I get to 15,000 degrees centigrade? The mathematics will say I can do that. Would I be fooling myself if I did that? KQLIW listening. Anybody want to give me their call letters? And you can tell by, I've given you kind of a hint when I said naively using the mathematics. Now, that magnifying glass and that focal point, that is an antenna. And you guys have listened to the TechNet for a long enough period of time, and you've heard that one of the granite laws, the bedrock of the antenna science, is reciprocity. Whatever gain, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, side-lobe level, polarization, whatever characteristics I get out of any passive antenna, an antenna that doesn't contain circulators and amplifiers and whatever, any passive antenna obeys reciprocity. That means whatever parameter I measure when I'm using the antenna as a transmitter, I get the exact same parameter when I measure within reception. If that antenna has got 11.5 dB of gain as a transmitter, at that frequency, at that polarization, at that angle of arrival, it's got 11.5 dB of gain as a receiver. If it's got a front-to-back ratio of 15 dB, whether I'm transmitting or receiving, I'm going to measure 15 dB of front-to-back ratio. Reciprocity. Okay. Once you accept reciprocity, you suddenly realize that you think you've got a receiving device. You're taking this beautiful chunk of solar energy, and you're focusing it down to a dot. That's the reception end of it. You can't stop the transmission. That hot little dot that you've created is simultaneously a transmitter. It is transmitting energy. The reflected energy from that hot dot is being transmitted back through that magnifying glass and refocused toward the sun. You look at the overall picture, the overall physics of this. You cannot make the dot hotter than the surface of the sun. If the source of your distributed energy from that half degree beamwidth, let me drop. That sun is a half a degree wide horizontally and vertically. So is the moon, by the way, half a degree wide. Something you can easily cover it up with your thumb held at an arm's length. So that half a degree diameter source of energy has a surface temperature in the vicinity of 5,500 degrees, I think it's centigrade. And you're focusing that dot, mathematically you're going to calculate some great big number for the temperature of that dot you focused. But that dot is a hot object simultaneously transmitting, and you can't stop it from doing that. You take any object, you raise it to a high temperature by, I forget whose law it is right now. It's not Lenz's law, Gauss's law. I'll eventually think of the guy's law. Any object is going to obey what's called T to the fourth. In other words, you take the real absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin, multiply, raise it to the fourth power. That is the rate at which energy is leaving that hot object. If I use the right kind of an infrared camera, the fact that your body is at 98 degrees Fahrenheit and the rest of the world around you is at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, on an infrared camera you show up as a bright white object. You're radiating energy like you wouldn't believe, as far as a very sensitive infrared camera is concerned. That's, again, reciprocity. That sun shines on you and it gives you heat. That food you put into your body... That food that you put into your body is being metabolized and it's generating heat. And that body of yours is going to keep itself at 98... It's going to keep itself at 98 degrees Fahrenheit or else you ain't alive. And, by the way, if you're doing a walk across to Antarctica and you run out of fuel to melt the snow so that you can make water that you drink, and you've got to have that water to mix with the food so that the metabolism can take place, you lose the fuel, you run out of fuel while you're walking across the South Pole area, and it's almost as bad as running out of fuel, because your body's going to make a great big investment to take that frozen snow around you, melt it into the liquid form, bring it up to 98 degrees Fahrenheit, and put it into your stomach in order to contribute to the metabolism, and that metabolism's got to be there in order for you to generate the heat in order to keep your body at 98. And if you don't, you ain't alive. So there's a lot of complicated physics going on in that case. But that hot dot that you make with that magnifying glass is a radiator. The bottom line of all of this reciprocity is you cannot make that dot any higher in temperature than the temperature of the surface of the sun. That's the absolute limit. Because of the way energy is flowing in and out at the exact same rate, if the system was perfect, if there was no loss in the lens, and you heated up some kind of material, and if you think you've got it above 5,500 degrees, then the amount of energy flowing back toward the sun would be greater than the amount of energy the sun is giving you. Reciprocity. So you're going to get a real hot spot, and you can do some good burning, and you could probably do some welding. And a guy who's done a lot of welding in his life is Paul, WS2N. And I'm pretty sure at 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, I can do some, 5,000 degrees centigrade, I'm pretty sure I can do welding. And can I really get to that temperature and do everything just right? I think I could weld with a great big magnifying glass. Let's see what you think about.
Repeater, time out.
Oxygen. He had Heliog at 10,000.
1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a little higher than this. The I think 7,000 for stick welding. So, but you can't have the oxygen. You'll wind up with, you know, if you're heating up steel, you'll wind up melting the steel, but you're going to wind up with nothing but porosity. And that thing won't hold anything. Very good, Dick. The bigger magnifying glass that you have, you keep going up and up and up, but okay, on the limit. But the limit of the sun is 27 million degrees. That's going out spherically. You're not going to get 27 million coming this way. So the number should be a lot lower than 27 million. What is it, 44,000? What do they call it? Begins with an F. But it's separated into 44, over 44,000 degrees. So I'm going to say this number is going to be significantly lower than 27 million. What do you think, Dick?
Oh, by a long shot. Now, you just hit some magic numbers. Heliarc is 10,000 degrees. I can't get there. And some of these other weldings are 5,700 degrees. I can't get there. Yes, the center of the sun, where the nuclear fusion is taking place, is at roughly 27 million degrees. And I think it's Fahrenheit, but it doesn't matter. However, that center of the sun is optically opaque to you and I. There's 500,000 miles of radius of stuff between the surface of the sun that you and I can see and that tiny little dot of nuclear fusion going on in the center. You can't get there from here. And that energy boiling off of that 27 million degrees in the center of that nuclear fusion takes 100,000 years to bubble up to the surface 500,000 miles away. That's how long it takes for that. In other words, if the sun suddenly decided to cut down its amount of power of its nuclear furnace in the center, and it did it today, in theory, you and I wouldn't know about it for 100,000 years. That's how long it takes for the stuff to bubble up to the surface. That surface that we can see, the real optical surface, is something like 5,600 degrees, 5,600 degrees. That's what we see. That's where that heat of energy that we get is coming from. And that, no matter how you focus it, no matter how big you're focusing it, you can get more and more watts into a bigger and bigger dot if you like. But because that dot is simultaneously retransmitting that energy back out in the other direction by the T to the fourth law of radiation, reciprocity, you can't stop the energy from pouring back out of there no matter what you do that I know of. And you're not going to get anywhere near. If you had 100% efficiency, you can get to 5,600 degrees. And if it takes 10,000 degrees to do heliarc welding, I ain't going to do heliarc welding. So there are lots of people who have cooked their hamburgers.
Repeater, time out.
There are lots of people who have cooked their hamburgers in heated water and did all kinds of things with solar energy. Ain't that interesting that we've never heard about anybody doing welding with solar energy? And now I'm beginning to see why. How about brazing? I believe if I did it just right, Paul, I could get to 3,000 degrees. Could I do brazing at 3,000? I know I ain't going to do heliarc welding. I'm not going to do normal steel welding because the temperatures are much bigger than I can generate with solar energy. But how about brazing? I'm assuming I could get to around 3,000 degrees with solar energy. Could I do brazing with solar with 3,000 degrees? WS2N, K2RIW.
I think you can get 1,500 watts, not 1,500 degrees for brazing, I think it is. I get the numbers offhand. Solder melts at 600 for soldering, so you can do soldering. Brazing, it's a little different. Then it's so fast, it's a little higher. It's actually going to make, if it's copper, you're going to heat the copper cherry red and apply a higher bars here made by Harris. Harris, that's 15% silver. And I'm trying to think of the temperature. I thought that was, I don't know, 1800 or something like that, coming out of the torch. You know, you need hotter torches. Some of them run on not gas, which I'm not a big fan of, but I think you'll get your higher temperatures out of that. But I would say if you can get up to 3,000-4,000, you can do bracing.
And you want to look at all the directions in space across the surface of a sphere. There's
1,000 square degrees on the surface of your globe, on the surface of a sphere. So 1 degree beam with antennas with high gain, and if you're willing to build an array of them, 41,000 antennas, yes, you could have all the gain you want in all the directions at once. Are you willing to make that big an investment in hardware and that many receivers? You can see where we're going here. So gain comes at a price. In the case of that 48 decibels of gain that the Voyager spacecraft has out there at the 124 astronomical units, something like 11 billion miles, and it talks back across that distance with a round trip time of, I think it was 32 hours or something like that. That beautiful high gain antenna that allows you to do that, you've got to very precisely aim that to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree. If you don't aim that antenna at Earth from Voyager, there ain't no communication. You're wasting your time. So the end of life in Voyager, I can see of two or three different ends of life here. Let me drop. One of them, the nuclear power supply, which had to be there, because when you're that far away from the sun, no matter how big your solar collector is, even square miles, you ain't going to get very much sunlight out there at that distance. So solar energy to run your satellite, forget it. So it's got a nuclear power supply. Whatever you use for the raw material of a fuel for the nuclear power supply, it's got a half-life. And it's slowly running out of half-life. And what it's doing, the material in your solar powers, in your nuclear power supply on that satellite, is taking those high-speed neutrons coming out of that nuclear reaction, the spontaneous neutrons, absorbing them and converting them thermally or electronically, I'm not sure which, into electrical energy. Well, the bombardment of your absorber in that nuclear power supply is being slowly degraded by that nuclear radiation. So your Peltier devices or your whatever the devices are that are converting the power out of the nuclear source into electrical energy, it's slowly degrading in efficiency. The power out of the nuclear source is slowly degrading. You're getting further and further away from the sun, where already they're out there where the temperature of free space is around 2.7 degrees Kelvin, so it's in a very cold environment. And if you're not running the heaters to run your cameras and whatever, you're not going to get a very good picture out of that camera. So the good news is you're not going to get fogging in the lens from moisture absorption. There ain't no moisture out there. Let me drop.
There's thermocouples for the conversion deck.
Okay, so the thermocouples, in other words, they've got a hot side and a cold side. The thermocouple really is a Peltier device running backwards. Isn't that true, Paul? In the case of a Peltier device, it's a diode-like device. You pour current through a Peltier device, one surface gets hot and the other surface gets cold. And you can do it backwards. You heat up one surface and you put a heat sink on the other surface, and the Peltier device run backwards is a kind of a thermocouple. It'll generate electrical energy. So, it's...
Repeater, timeout.
Is that approximately what the power supply is? Kind of a, the thermocouple is a kind of a Peltier device went backwards for Paul, WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I always wanted to buy one of those refrigerators, no compressors involved, nothing. That's the way to go. That's the way to go, you know, like the camping or something. But I never did. Peltier device, yeah, the thermocouple, that's, yeah, just dissimilar metals and, you know, one might be copper, might be zinc, I forget what it is, on a Voyager, and yeah, dozens and dozens and dozens of these things, and each one is developing a voltage, of course, capable of developing a certain amount of amperage. They're all connected in series, parallel, and to do that, it's, you know, these things are all surrounded in graphite blankets, and it's incorporated in, you know, in the center of this thing is the plutonium just giving off, like you said, neutrons before. And that's what these, all these radio, thermoelectric, yeah, that's where they get the thermocouples, thermoelectric generators consist of, including Curiosity riding around on Mars right now. Actually,
but here's the real bottom line. I was starting to say now there's a number of ways that Voyager is going to run out of life. The thermal generator is going into a half-life problem. The thermocouples that are coupling the heat energy into electricity, they're slowly degrading. The transmitter itself, the traveling wave tube and its cathode, is slowly running out of steam. However, that 12-foot diameter dish aimed at Earth with a 0.6 of a degree by some magic, that spacecraft can aim its dish in three-dimensional space with an accuracy of a couple of tenths of a degree. Paul, how the hell are they doing that? Guarantee it's not an inertial wheel, because it would have run down and broken up, and it would have used up its bearing and whatever. And if it's doing it with rocket power, where in the world is the thrust generators, where's the fuel coming from to do that? How the heck for 35 years have they aimed that dish to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree? How are they doing that, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet?
World's best momentum generators, gyros on board the stick. Three of them put spacecraft and they keep functioning. So, that's how they do all their adjusting. They want to turn that spacecraft to take a reading, activate one of the momentum wheels and put the torque on the craft and moves it a little bit. That's how they do it. Yeah, they stop fuel on board, but very little. So, there you go. That's how they're doing it. It's amazing. In fact, they directed it about a half a year ago to turn. They wanted to take some readings of where the cosmic rays were. They trying to figure out where they were with the heliosphere. And then they programmed it to make sure it, turn back toward Earth. And they did. And the way they do that, by the way, is they still have the star trackers. They do have star trackers on board. And that's how they know where they are in three-dimensional space.
Okay, they're doing it with momentum wheels. And those momentum wheels on the three axes of the Voyager spacecraft have survived for 35 years. What brand name are those reaction wheels, those momentum wheels on Voyager? And why in the world didn't NASA use that same brand name of momentum wheels on Kepler and on Hubble? Hubble is always grinding up its inertial, its momentum wheels. Kepler ground up two of its momentum wheels. And these three momentum wheels on Voyager are still cranking 35 years later. That's a damn good brand name. We've got to go to that brand name, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet.
It has a lot to do with usage. They do use, that spacecraft is spinning. It's been stabilized to some degree. So, but when they got around and, to taking pictures around planets, it wasn't been stabilized. It was pretty much using the momentum wheel to stop the spin. They had a platform on board with cameras and everything, and they were able to adjust everything and take pictures of whatever they were looking for when they went past on a planet. But then they spun it back up again. So it's pretty much never used. It's spin stabilized spacecraft. And if they want to make an adjustment, they'll turn these things on and make an adjustment. So I don't think they're spinning all the time. It's not like something mechanically going for 35 years. Maybe not. I really haven't researched. Who's it made by? I don't know. Jet Propulsion Laboratory put it all together 35 years ago. But I might have to research. I'm sure they had a contractor, of course, involved in that.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, Paul. In the case of Voyager, it does very little reorientation. It just keeps aiming that dish 99.9% of the time. The dish is aimed at the Earth. The whole spacecraft is rotating, so it's got spin stabilization. And very little re-aiming is required. By comparison, the Hubble Space Telescope, every couple of days somebody says, all right, that's experiment number 47. Now I'm going to do experiment number 48. This thing that's as big as a school bus, and it's got tons of weight, and we're going to re-aim it in some other direction, because I want to look at some other part of space. So you're continuously making heavy use out of those momentum wheels on Hubble to re-aim it at the next target for the next experiment. You're doing that all the time. And the same thing with Kepler. Kepler, although it's aimed in one particular particular direction in the Cygnus galaxy. Let me drop. Kepler is really in orbit around the Sun. It's not in orbit around the Earth, if I understand correctly. And in that orbit around the Sun, you have to reorient Kepler around its major axis. You do a 90-degree turn 4 times per year to make sure its solar cells are aimed at the Sun. So it's a pretty massive object, and you're doing a complete rotation, 90 degrees, 4 times per year with Kepler. But the worst-case situation is with Hubble, a massive object, and you're re-aiming it not just around one axis, but you're re-aiming it in X, Y, and Z axis multiple times per month, most likely, probably hundreds of times per year. You're taking this massive telescope and re-aiming it all by the effect of those inertial wheels. So those momentum wheels are getting very heavy use on Hubble, and not quite as heavy use, but pretty heavy use on Kepler. And I think that explains how we're burning them up. Sound right, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW in the tech net.
Oh yeah, no question about it. And you know, you can carry fuel on board. Kepler has it. But if they're going to use their fuel to do what they got to do 4 times a year, they're going to go through that like in no time flat. So, I mean, they could extend the mission a little bit by doing that, but they're going to have a tough time. And you said Cygnus. Oh, I forgot where that is. That thing was born. Big dub. I've looked at that. Okay. Yeah, the Voyager does not have those problems. It's spin stabilized. A lot of satellites early on that just carried omnidirectional satellites, omnidirectional antennas 30, 40 years ago when these things were first launched. Well, spin stabilized. That's how they did it. And then that was okay for, you know, transmitting signals back to Earth, make sure everything's okay, Sputnik, all that. But then when they realized that we need cameras, they got to be pointing in certain directions. We have instruments that we want to detect. Different things on Earth, or maybe on the Sun, or wherever it might be. This thing has got to be pretty much stable. Stay in one spot. We can't have this thing spinning all over. We also have directional antennas. It's okay if it's going in one direction, like Voyager or Pioneer. The other two Pioneer missions that are also outside the solar system that are no longer functioning. Spin stabilization works. When you want to point, a camera in a certain direction, you want to point an antenna in a certain direction, you need momentum wheels or gyro type of equipment to keep not only stabilized, but you want to move it a few degrees one way or the other, spin one up a little bit more than the other, and your spacecraft will rotate. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul, and Westwick, recognize, going to get to you in a second. By way of the fuel on board and those thrusters, you can do some unwinding of a momentum wheel. In other words, because of some kind of a cumulative error, one of your momentum wheels, eventually you're going to be spinning it up at maximum RPM, and the only way you can unwind it without reorienting the spacecraft is to slowly unwind the wheel, slow it down, at the same time you're using a thruster, so the two compensate each other. So the thrusting fuel on board is a very finite source that you're going to burn through pretty fast if you're not doing very efficient things. And I think they're coming up with various schemes right now for Kepler by which, with the combination of the thrusters they've got on board and the two wheels that are still functioning, they think they can get some of the accuracy back. And yes, Kepler is aimed at the Cygnus galaxy. The Cygnus constellation, it's not a galaxy, the Cygnus constellation is a cross-shaped object, is the way we usually draw the lines between those stars. And at the bottom of that cross is that double star called Albireo, a red and a blue star, which are very a lot of fun to look at with your backyard telescope, to see two stars side by side, very close together. One is reddish in color, one is bluish in color. It's called Albireo, and that's at the lower tip of the so-called Cygnus constellation. And a little bit off to one side of the Cygnus constellation is where Kepler has been aimed for the last couple of years. It's a chunk of space which I think is considerably smaller than the area of the moon. And it's just staring in that one direction, looking at, let me drop it.
The Neb is over there too as well, right? Isn't this called the Northern Cross as well?
I don't think Cygnus is called the Northern Cross. I don't think so. It might be.
Yes, it is, Dick.
I'll take your word for it. It is the Northern Cross, anyhow. A little bit off to one side is where Kepler is aimed, and it's looking at roughly 100 or 150,000 stars simultaneously, making very precise measurements of the amount of light out of each one, and if that light out of any one of them goes down by a very small fraction of 1%, meaning that a planet has just waved itself in front of that star, because we just happen to be looking at that solar system edgewise, and there's very few of them, but you use the mathematics to find out what percentage, so to speak, and so if that planet waves itself in front of that star, and you see the light go down, and you carefully measure how long it goes down, that tells you how far out that particular planet is, and if you wait the full year until that planet comes around the second time, then your candidate planet has just become a confirmed planet. Once you see it the second time, and you get the exact same shape of light curve the second time around. That's how Kepler is doing his detecting. And I think right now it's got something like 2,700 candidate planets, and something like 260 of them have been confirmed. Is that approximately the numbers, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Candidate number was probably right. That rings well. I thought they had 137, but maybe more. Okay, maybe it is more. I don't know. I did hear that even if this thing shuts down, the scientists have got enough information from this to keep them going for at least a couple more years to, you know, sift through the data. So, hey, you know, we wait till 2017. What's that, 4 years down the road, and we'll get a test up there that's like, you know, Kepler 2. Very good. John, by the way, I'm glad it wasn't as serious as I thought, but you went in for that one thing, but I don't know, going to the hospital freaks me out, so I'm glad you were on the air. Back to you there, Dick.
Yeah, we're going to turn it over to Paul in a couple of minutes, John, for the mailbag. Wes, I know you had a question. N2XJN, K2LIW, in the second hand.
I just want to go for a moment to that what you discussed before, which was the Mera and Andy Mera case, where the black hole could separate them, so to say the Mera could be inhaled by the black hole, Andy Mera could be left over. Because at the beginning of I asked about the properties of the border zone, that you got. But at the same time, you were talking about the energy level of the antimatter, and eventually you were talking about the power parameters of the space objects. Now, what I didn't mention, and I think you've heard about, in 2008. A Titan laser was aimed at 1 millimeter thick gold target and was used to generate a positron and electron pairs in large numbers. So, my understanding is that the science is already in tool, in possession of tool, of the energy manipulation or energy equation. I have an article that is a scientific article from 1998, which actually described the production of pair, which would be then electron and anti-electron, or say particle, anti-particle, by itself, by simply very same phenomena that is being used for the spectrometry, which is the decay shell when we try to throw out the electron for the case of Baitei, the very much energetic photon, that is when we create the matter and antimatter, but then in K, you create a hole. What is happening in that hole, there are two electrons from, say, L shell are trying to get into. Now, we may have a different kind of scenario, the collision between two of them, because they try to fill up the same hole or eventually extraction of one more of them. But anyhow, the creation of antimatter is not a magic right now to the science. I'm going to send you after the technical, the article that I'm relating to. Enter it here.
Yeah, by way of the current particle accelerators, they are able to generate some antimatter. And CERN does have this article saying that they were able to hold on to a chunk of antimatter, a piece of positron, into a chamber for as long as 15 minutes. And if they can come up with a technique where they lower its temperature more, that really means lower its speed, lower its velocity, even more, so that it really is a completely steady object in the middle of your chamber, and then you can wait long enough and find out which direction it drifts. Does it float upward? Does it fall up away from gravity as opposed to fall down? It's a big question that people have got, because we really don't know what the heck gravity is. Lots and lots of speculations, but nobody's really come up with a good theory of what is gravity. By way of knowing that mass creates gravity, and now you've got this boson, the Higgs boson, which we think makes gravity. Let me drop it. Starting to get a little bit of a handle on gravity, but it sure would be nice if a positron would fall up instead of fall down. But you've got to get it into a very, very low velocity state to find out which direction it's going to fall. Because right now the chamber they put it in was controlling it, not gravity. And it's a rather light object by normal standards, if you know what I mean. And you were saying something about a black hole makes antimatter. I'm not so sure about that.
Oh, no. Black hole is being used to separate. In other words, you have the particle and antiparticle, where one has a positive charge and the other one doesn't have. So the black hole does is simply separate them. That's where sent by the border properties, like in Job.
You said it's going to separate them, but in this particular universe, in this particular solar system, in this particular galaxy, if I've got a black hole, everything around it, per se, is all matter, not antimatter. So how can it be separating matter from antimatter if, per se, there is no local antimatter? Over to US, K2RAW.
When you're talking about our solar system, it's a quite different story. We're talking about your example of the matter and antimatter and the positioning, the spatial positioning of those two phenomena. So you say, there is the Milky Way and there is another galactic, and they might in the future collide as they represent matter and antimatter. Ladies up. So I ask you then the simple question: what are the properties of the border zone? And then the black hole would be one of the necessities between them to separate them and eventually put one to one bin and the other one to the other bin. As a black hole says that, the region around the black hole takes one particle that may escape, and it is the antimatter or antiparticle, and is captured, let's say, not captured by the black hole.